When you're ready.
May it please the Court. My name is Michelle King. I'm a certified law student representative from the University of St. Thomas. And along with my colleague Joy Nissen and our supervising attorney Gregory Sisk, we represent the appellant, Mr. Scott Nordstrom. I will watch my own time. However, I would like to reserve 7 minutes.
Seven, okay.
7 minutes for rebuttal by Ms. Sisk.
And would your co-counsel is going to take that time?
Yes, she okay. will, Your Honor. Thank you. During the direct appeal of his capital sentence, Mr. Nordstrom wrote a letter to the attorney appointed by the court to assist him. And he gave that letter enclosed in an unsealed envelope, clearly marked as legal mail, properly addressed to his attorney, to a corrections officer who removed the letter from the envelope and proceeded to read it. Today, we ask this court to join the many circuits that have held that a prisoner indeed has a First Amendment free speech right to confidentiality and outgoing legal mail to his attorney. In Lemon versus Duggar, the 11th Circuit stated it is a violation of an inmate's constitutional rights for the prison officials to read legal mail. And in Jones versus Brown, the 3rd Circuit clearly explained what it is that violation exactly is under the First Amendment. And that while Jones versus Brown did address just the risk of reading, Jones versus Brown stated that a state pattern or practice or explicit policy of opening legal mail outside the presence of the inmate interferes with protected communications, stripping them of their confidentiality, and it accordingly impinges upon the inmate's right to freedom of speech.
What can the state do, in your view, in the presence of the writer, prisoner, to make sure that there's not bad stuff in there?
Well, Your Honor, Mr. Nordstrom does not object to an inspection for contraband. Opening up the letter, as he did, he presented the letter to the corrections officer and unsealed this fine as well. And to leaf through the document itself is fine to search.
So if he's sending physical material out of the jail, I'm not quite sure. Usually you're more worried about, you know, hacksaws coming into the jail instead of hacksaws leaving the jail. But if there's obviously the sort of shaking it and so on will probably figure out whether you've got stuff in there. But what happens if the letter, while sent to the lawyer, contains in the writing of it a plot to do something that is clearly illegal?
Well,
now, is the jail disabled from reading that?
Certainly not if the jail has some type of individualized suspicion, probable cause to suspect that an inmate is indeed in collusion with their attorney and plotting something along those lines. Now, several cases have stated that is speculative, though. It's a very remote possibility. And in our situation, the state of Arizona does not have such reasonable or probable cause or some type of suspicion. They've offered nothing to that.
But it would have to be particular to him.
Well, yes, Your Honor. I mean, I should clarify that Mr. Nordstrom is seeking an injunction for himself. He is not representing a class of inmates.
What if Mr. Nordstrom had sent a letter and it didn't say legal mail on the outside? Could the jail read it going out?
Yes, Your Honor, certainly.
Okay. So how are they supposed to know that when he wrote legal mail on the outside that it actually is legal mail?
Well, first of all, it is my understanding that the state of Arizona allows inmates to send out 10 letters each month, or they are given 10 envelopes or have the opportunity to use 10 envelopes that are stamped legal mail. They receive those from the prison itself. So they're limited there. They cannot just take an ordinary envelope and write on it legal mail.
Okay, so they get the 10 letters, but how does the jail know that the contents are actually for a lawyer and relate to a legal matter, as opposed to something that says, dear lawyer, please give this to my friends.
Right, right.
And then it's got instructions on a jailbreak. So how does the jail prevent that kind of a thing? If you told me that absolutely they can read the mail if it's not legal mail.
Correct.
So how does the jail verify that when they've taken an envelope that says legal mail, that it's actually legal mail inside?
Well, you're speaking of the two, you know, one half of the equation, essentially. Yes, the prison has an interest in preventing exactly that from happening. But we must consider that against the inmates' First Amendment rights to free speech and the confidentiality of that communication with his attorney. So, yes, the prison has an interest in that. I would really certainly hope that there aren't that many attorneys that would participate in that type of a scheme. And certainly in Mr. Nordstrom's case, he truly just wanted to communicate freely and openly.
Sure, but the fact that he just wanted to communicate freely and openly with his attorney is not going to be shared by those who are responsible for checking the mail. So how do we balance his interests against the interests of the jail if they have to take his word for it that when he says I'm sending legal mail, that he's actually sending legal mail?
Right, Your Honor. Well, the Supreme Court has already said when it's outgoing mail, that the prison security, their interest in that mail, the concerns related to security, is of categorically lesser magnitude than that with incoming mail. And so the court should look to Procunier versus Martinez, which was cited by Thornburg versus Abbott. And the controlling law, therefore, is that a prison regulation of outgoing mail, and notably Procunier was discussing any outgoing mail, not legal mail as we have here. But that
in the case here in front of us, was this particular piece of outgoing legal mail addressed to one of his counsel of record?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the jail or prison have that name available to it, that this was his counsel of record?
I do not believe that the state of Arizona, as some states do, require that an inmate register their attorney with them. Mr. Nordstrom would have no problem if that was going to be the case. But I do believe that it is in the record that they were aware that he was represented. He was in the middle of his direct appeal of his capital sentence. And again, it was clearly marked. I believe her name was Sharmila Roy, Esquire at the end, and again, it was in an appropriate.
And there's no dispute that, in fact, this. Well, I guess I can ask the state when it stands up, but there's no dispute that this, in fact, was addressed to his counsel for purposes of this capital appeal.
That is my understanding. You're correct, right, Your Honor.
Counsel, you're making a First Amendment argument. You've only pressed your First Amendment argument on here at oral argument, but you've got other rights that appear to be a better fit here: access to courts, and particularly the attorney-client privilege. Both of those rights require proof of actual injury, but your First Amendment right you claim does not. Is that the strategy, that you can't win this case if you have to show actual injury?
No, Your Honor. We just believe that the First Amendment argument is the most streamlined and the precedent has.
But it's the most general of those arguments. The others seem to be far more sort of narrowed. That is, a right of counsel and a right of access to courts seem to be far more narrowed than a broad amorphous First Amendment right to speak to one's attorney.
Well, both the Third Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit, the Third in Jones versus Brown and the Eleventh in Alameen versus Smith, have used the First Amendment for that vehicle.
And there are other courts that have doubted that, the Seventh prominently.
That is correct. But they're all legal vehicles to the same outcome. Mm-hmm. But to address.
Well, not necessarily, because if you have to go to the others, you have an additional proof. You have an additional burden that you don't have with the First Amendment.
Your Honor, I am happy to answer that question. I would like to note, though, I am running out of time. I do have to reserve the time.
Let's do this. We'll ask you questions as long as we want, and you can answer them as you think appropriate, and we will save 7 minutes for your co-counsel. So don't be too nervous about this.
Thank you very much.
And for those young people here in the audience, you should know that panels vary in how hard-nosed they are about time. So don't take this necessarily of what's going to happen with the next panel with another set of judges. But that's what we're going to do.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, I've got a variation on Judge Bybee's question, which is, well, let's assume for a moment that we are talking either attorney-client privilege or access to court, and you're seeking an injunction against reading of mail to his counsel of record in this capital appeal or later on a habeas. What kind of injury would you have to show, and what kind of injury would you try to show?
Well, Your Honor, okay, first of all, because he is seeking injunctive relief, this court held in Armstrong versus Davis that to be entitled to such relief, the inmate need only show that he is realistically threatened by repetition of that experience. Of course, there are two avenues to show that. One is that there's a policy, and that that there was a policy by the prison, and that the injury stemmed from that, or that there's a pattern of officially sanctioned behavior. And so when there is a policy, what Armstrong stated was that if it is directly, the harm is directly traceable to that policy, there's an implicit likelihood of its repetition in the immediate future.
And so if the behavior is repeated, what's the harm?
The harm is the chilling of the communication between the inmate and the attorney, that invasion, that deliberate intrusion into the confidentiality.
But you're arguing then, in terms of chilling effect, that the inmate might not write certain things if he was concerned that the guards were going to read it?
Exactly, Your Honor.
And how strong do we have to have that inference? I understand the might part. Does it have to be probably? I mean, how do we... I can have some instincts about this, but it's hard for me to arrive at a very concrete notion of how much chilling might take place.
Well, I guess in part, Your Honor, that would depend on the inmate, perhaps. But here, he has directly alleged that he self-censored his communications at a critically important time of his direct appeal.
No, but if he's just alleging chilling, that's all you have to show under the... We assume that under the First Amendment. And if that's all the injury you have to show in order to prove injury under your Sixth Amendment rights, your 14th Amendment rights, then that's really no burden at all.
Well, Your Honor, yes. But the other thing to note is, well, several things here. First of all, this case was dismissed at the pleadings. And Mr. Nordstrom has not had the opportunity for discovery or to present any more evidence. And also noting that because he was a pro se inmate, his complaint does need to be construed liberally.
Did he allege that the state did anything with the information it got? Did the officer do anything with the information that he gleaned from this letter?
Well, again, going back to my previous response, we really truly do not know.
Okay, but he didn't allege anything.
He did not know. What he was concerned with and what he alleged, again, was that chilling effect that he experienced, that he self-censored his communications. And the other thing I would like to point as well is that going back to the injury requirement under the assistance of counsel, typically, of course, that is the Strickland prejudice test, and I am aware of the holdings of this court in Danielson, U.S. v. Danielson, following Weatherford v. Bussey. But notably, those are retrospective, backward-looking cases. What we have here with Mr. Nordstrom, again, he's seeking prospective relief. We believe that rather than using the standards that have been applied or set in those cases, that it is more appropriate to look to Lucky v. Harris, an 11th Circuit decision, and Benjamin v. Frazier, a 2nd Circuit decision. And that is this, is that in an ongoing proceeding, the right of an accused to assistance of counsel is provided directly by the Constitution. And an inmate does not need to assert a denial of that right that has resulted in actual injury. And it's a very considerable difference, I think, factually, our case, what it represents here, in contrast to the others.
Good. Why don't we hear from the other side, and then your co-counsel will have some time.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Neil Singh. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the State of Arizona, which is an amicus curiae in this case.
Because you didn't appear at all below, correct?
That's right. I mean, we were given the option of either appearing or not appearing. We made the judgment call. We weren't given an opportunity to respond before the district court. So, Your Honor, I guess one of the challenges we have in this case is that the gist of the opening brief filed by Mr. Nordstrom's counsel focused on the Sixth Amendment. Now hearing that perhaps their primary argument is the First Amendment issue, the free speech issue, and I think the problem, the flaw with their argument, if it's going to rely on the free speech issue, is that the one case that they primarily, I think, they rely upon is the Third Circuit decision, Jones versus Brown. And that was a case which is like many of the other cases decided on this issue in all the circuits, almost all the circuits, where the state specifically sought to open legal mail outside of the inmate's presence. This is a New Jersey decision. New Jersey officials reacting right after 9/11. They were reacting.
Let me see if we can narrow what we've got here in front of us. Are you contending, let's assume that the allegations are true. Obviously, they may or may not turn out to be that way. But the allegation is that he had an envelope, legal mail, addressed to someone, Esquire, who was in fact his lawyer for purposes of the capital appeal. And if the guard didn't know that that was actually his lawyer, he could have found that out. The guard takes out the letter and reads it. That's the allegation. Are you saying that the prison, in the circumstance here, without any prior indication that he's trying to accomplish something nefarious by sending it to his lawyer who will then pass it on to some da-da-da-da-da, are you saying that the prison guard has the right to read that legal mail?
I would say that the prison guard does not have the right to read the legal mail. I would say that the prison guard has the right to do what the policy says, which is to read it to the extent to make sure that it's contraband, no more.
Now, does the policy say read or scan? Or what's the word in the policy?
And perhaps this is where this confusion lies. The policy first says that there is no reading. The prison guards cannot read the mail. And it's a flat prohibition. There shall be no reading. The policy then states that reading is permitted to the extent to establish that the letter is not contraband. And it chose the word reading. But
what would it have to be contraband for a letter to be contraband?
A letter can be contraband if it contains, for example, instructions for the recipient to get in touch with somebody. It contains an address. It contains telephone numbers. If it contains bank account information or somebody's social security number, those are all ways that a letter itself can constitute.
But you know, if I'm a guard and I'm not only authorized to, but it's part of my job to read insofar as necessary to determine whether the letter contains these forbidden things, I think I have to read every word. I mean, you know, it could be in the last paragraph. So I think your understanding of the policy, as you've described it to me, requires the guard to read every word. Isn't that right?
Well, I think what happened here, but we're talking about a matter of seconds, Your Honor. The 15 seconds is slightly longer than it took me to just introduce myself to this court. A very short amount of time.
I understand that. But I'm asking you now about what you think the policy requires.
Well, the policy requires a skimming. I think that throughout
But then I think you said it requires a reading insofar as necessary to determine that there's no contraband in the letter, in the text of the letter. Did you say that?
Yes, I did.
So, and if something in there qualifies as contraband in the sense that we're talking about, is contact Joe, who will tell you where to get the account number for the stolen money that you can then use to pay yourself. Let's assume that's contraband. That could be in the last paragraph. So how does the deputy do his job under this reading without reading the entire letter?
The correctional officer has to take the two provisions at issue and interpret them to mean, I'm not allowed to read through this letter. I'm not allowed to digest what the letter is saying, what it's talking about.
Well, in other words, the guard will not be able to determine whether or not there are forbidden things in the letter.
Well, Your Honor, it is an imperfect situation.
Well, I'm trying to understand what it is, and I'm having trouble because I think I'm hearing two things at once.
Well, like I said, Your Honor, it is a difficult and imperfect situation. That's the best. You know, there's no other way that I can think of, and certainly no other way the Supreme Court could think of, to balance the interests at issue here. We do have competing interests. We do have the prisoner's right to communicate with his attorney. We also have the demonstrated interest of prisons to ensure security, and that's why the Supreme Court came up with a procedure that I think has worked largely well since 1974 from the Wolf versus McDonald case, that it's an imperfect situation, but if you're reading the letter in the inmate's presence, then that itself ensures a whole variety.
Okay, but you just used the word reading, so I'm trying to figure out not only what the policy is, but what your position is. Is your position that the guard has the right to read the entire text of the letter to determine whether there's something in it that is forbidden?
No. I would say that the guard does not have the right to read line by line the entire text of the letter. I would say the guard has the right to skim the letter, look for buzzwords that guards are trained to look for something that stands out, and that's about it. And, Your Honor, I would point in this regard, you know, because these words become very important, reading, skimming, inspecting. The U.S. Supreme Court in Wolf v. McDonnell used the term inspection and perusal. And I think the exact quote was, freedom from censorship does not mean freedom from inspection and perusal.
It's curious that you'd use that, because the in the policy, I'm looking at 902.11, and I'm looking at 1.4.2.1, it's talking about incoming mail may be scanned, but it shall not be read or censored. But the word scanned doesn't appear in 1.4.2.2, which is the outgoing legal mail. It says they shall not be read or censored, but shall be inspected. And then it says it are not prohibited from reading. And if that word said scanned or inspected or perused or something less than reading, the state would probably have a much stronger case. It's very difficult when you use the same word. You shall not read, but you may read.
You're right. I mean, I think it would probably be clearer. But I think the thrust and the gist of these words, all these words, read, skim, scan, peruse, inspect, they all mean the same or similar things to a prison guard. The guards and the officers know they are not to read the letter for the sake of reading the letter. They are to inspect, they are to check, they are to quickly scan to the extent, only to the extent necessary to establish that the letter is not itself contraband.
What do you do with the hypothetical, which is not, I think, our case here, but raised in one of the amicus briefs, where the legal mail was alleging or was describing very bad behavior by the guards? And if the guard is allowed even to skim it, the inmates are going to be, at least they fear, in big trouble from the guards. How do you deal with that case?
Well,
I understand that's not the case we have here in front
sure.
of us.
Sure. I think that's the reason why the Wolf procedure works. Inmate writes accusations against a prison guard to his attorney, wants to report this conduct to an attorney. Let's say that the guard reads it right in the inmate's presence. So now the inmate knows that he read it in his presence. And
or even skimmed it.
Or skimmed it.
Yeah, but a quick skim will say, you know, deputy so-and-so beat the daylights out of inmate so-and-so.
Sure. So I think that the reason the procedure works is the letter goes to the attorney, or let's say that it doesn't go to the attorney. The inmate's going to find out one way or another that, hey, I wrote a letter to my attorney. I never heard anything.
But that's not what the inmate's worried about. What the inmate's worried about is as soon as he makes an accusation against the guard that so-and-so beat so-and-so, that the inmate is going to get punished in a whole variety of ways.
Well,
and that's not unrealistic in some circumstances.
And if that's taking place, Your Honor, I think that's the purpose for giving the inmate access to the courts. If that is taking place, if a guard is reading the letter and retaliating against the prisoner because of his reading that letter, that's a much better case.
But that's after the fact, after the inmate has, you know, been very severely beaten by the guard. Hey, thanks a lot.
Sure.
I mean, so if I'm an inmate and the guards are misbehaving terribly and I want to report that to my lawyer and I know that the guard is going to read it before it gets to my lawyer and I want to avoid being severely punished by the guard, I don't write it.
Well, you know, the inmate also has the ability to call his attorney if he is that concerned that the very prison guard he is complaining about has the ability to read his letter in his presence. There are other ways to contact his attorney, which, by the way, is a method of communication that has been recognized by other circuits as being a legitimate reason why some monitoring of legal mail should be permitted.
Yeah, and that may be a sufficient answer for some of these. I'm worried about the guards finding out about my reporting on it. It probably is not a sufficient answer if we're talking about the sort of communication that may be at issue here, either on direct appeal or particularly on habeas for, if you have it's a capital case with penalty phase at issue and it's hard to report that over the telephone when what he's going to say is three pages worth of terrible abuse he suffered as a child. I mean, I think we can all assume that some of those things are not very well done by telephone, that they're better done by mail. If we were to say that we're looking at either access to courts or attorney-client privilege, and we're looking at an injunction suit where the injunction sought is don't read my mail beyond a quick skim or whatever that's going to be, what form of harm do we need to show to support such an injunction?
The harm needs to be some tangible impact on the actual relationship between the prisoner and his attorney that is preventing his access to the courts. I mean, the Sixth Amendment is about the effective assistance of counsel during criminal proceedings. And there has been not even an allegation, despite being given two opportunities. The lower court dismissed, citing the lack of actual injury, and then gave Mr. Norsom 30 more days to amend his complaint, and he did amend his complaint. No factual allegations. This is not an abstract legal concept which he would require an attorney for. Absolutely no allegation that his appellate proceeding before the Arizona Supreme Court was impacted in any way. Was there a critical mitigating fact about his personal life that needed to be communicated to his attorney?
Does he allege that there's certain things he's impeded or discouraged from saying, given the knowledge that the guard is going to read the letter?
Only in a very general sense, he says that his ability to communicate has been chilled. Very general, nothing specific. It's not even the case that he said that there is something specific, but I don't want to say it in a public court document. He doesn't even say that. He simply has this general allegation that his communications with his attorney have been chilled.
Yeah, it's a pretty high hurdle at this point for a lay person to say, well, I didn't say X, and because I didn't say X, I suffered the following adverse legal consequence.
Well, I don't know, Your Honor, that it's a factual allegation. Did something happen? Did his attorney not receive a communication that he really needed her to receive that would make some sort of a difference before the Arizona Supreme Court?
But we all know, and I'll even take this outside of the prison context, lay people coming into a lawyer, they'll tell a story for an hour, and the lawyer will pick out of that story things that are legally relevant that the person telling the story might have not attached great importance to. And the things that the person telling the story attached great importance to are quite irrelevant legally. I mean, it's very hard for the non-legally trained person to sort this out.
It can be hard, Your Honor. I would say that the court is really going to have to try and speculate on Mr. Nordstrom's behalf in order to reach that conclusion. It just seems like this is not an abstract legal or a complex factual point. Did something happen? Did something bad happen to you because you were afraid to write letters to your attorney because of this one incident?
Or you're afraid to say some things in letters that you do write. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And, of course, we don't have any allegations that Officer Hawthorne retaliated, that he ever did this on a repetitive basis or anything else.
Okay.
My time is up, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. I think it was 7 minutes.
May it please the court. My name is Joy Nissen, and I'm also representing the appellant, Mr. Scott Nordstrom. Your Honors, Wolf versus McDonald does not state that reading in the presence or reading at all is permissible under the Constitution. What Wolf stated was that a policy requiring opening legal mail in the presence of the prisoner ensured the prophylactic purpose of ensuring that the mail would not be read. At the time that the policy in question came before the court in Wolf, Reading was off the table. The prison policy that had originally allowed reading, the prison was no longer asserting that they had the right to apply that policy. So the issue was how best to protect the confidentiality of attorney-client communications, and the court came down with the opening in the presence. But at no time has the Supreme Court...
If the court's concern in Wolf was with the confidentiality of attorney-client privileges, but you have shifted your argument from attorney-client to First Amendment in order to avoid the question of harm, isn't there a danger here that the First Amendment will subsume the Sixth Amendment? That is, that the question of attorney-client privilege will become irrelevant because we'll have a much broader right with a much lesser burden of proof under the First Amendment? In which case, Wolf becomes irrelevant.
Your Honor, whether the court chooses to apply the First Amendment argument or the Sixth Amendment argument, again, we assert that they're legal vehicles to the same end. With respect to the Sixth Amendment argument...
It may be, but they're different burdens on your client.
May be, Your Honor. However, if this court follows the approach of the Second Circuit in Benjamin v. Frazier and then also in Lucky v. Harris, Fifth Circuit case, the requirement of showing ongoing actual injury does not apply to an ongoing proceeding. In Benjamin v. Frazier, the court held that the plaintiff prisoners were entitled to injunctive relief when they showed that city jail regulations resulted in substantial and unpredictable delays.
Are you contending the regulations are infirm here or the actions that were used against your client?
That's another important thing to clarify, Your Honor. The policy that Mr. Nordstrom is seeking an injunction against is located on page 93 of the record, where after four stages of the grievance process, Mr. Nordstrom's complaint about having Officer Hoffman read his legal mail, the director's office noted that Officer Hoffman was simply following policy and that staff is not prohibited from reading to ensure that the content of the mail is of legal subject matter. So this is the policy that Nordstrom is seeking to enjoin as applied to himself.
But the jail officers would be entitled to verify that it was, in fact, legal mail.
The officers are entitled, under our claim, to verify that it is legal mail in a number of ways, as long as it does not intrude upon the actual substance of the legal mail. For example, verifying the outside of the envelope, that it's being sent to an attorney, requiring the prisoner to submit a list.
What if the letter contained things that were clearly relevant to ongoing legal proceedings before the Arizona Supreme Court? So there was no question about that. But there was this sort of P.S. that Judge Fletcher described that says, if you want to get paid, you know, the money's buried in a box here. Now, that would be sort of a mixed problem, wouldn't it? Because that would be contraband under the state's definition. But everything else would clearly be legal mail. So can the state guard against that by looking through the letter?
Your Honor, the Supreme Court in Pecunier noted that a situation such as that to which you're referring is speculative. And so when we have...
Well, it is speculative, but I need to know the answer.
Right.
I realize it's not your case, but I need to be able to think through what we're going to do here.
If the prison had some kind of individualized suspicion that there was non-legal
Why does it have to have individualized suspicion?
I'm sorry?
Why does it have to have individualized suspicion?
In order to protect the First Amendment freedoms. The Supreme Court noted in Pecunier that with outgoing legal mail, which is, again, of a categorically lesser risk to the prison system, the regulation or the interest of the government must be important or substantial, and the limitation on First Amendment freedoms must be no more than necessary or essential to the protection of that interest.
How broad is the interest of the prison in preventing, I'll call it generically, bad communications? I'm thinking, for example, of my hypothetical that Judge Bybee's, I think, described better. Here's the money, it's in the box, da-da-da-da-da. Or other communication that says, on April 13th, here's what we're going to do to break out of jail. In the first example, it seems to me there's nothing in that communication, even though it's encouraging or facilitating illegal behavior, that threatens the security of the prison. In the second example, what we've got there very much threatens the security of the prison. Does the prison have an interest for purposes of inspecting mail against generally illegal behavior or is their interest confined to things that affect the security of the prison?
The Department of Corrections of Arizona has a definition of contraband in its regulations. It's not specifically within the legal mail context, but the definition describes only items that are of risk to the prison system. It doesn't describe content. So, but also in response to your question, the Lynn Stewart case, in which Ms. Stewart was a criminal confederate of her client, the client was in the Federal Bureau of Prisons. These were in-person meetings with her client, not mail or phone meetings. And in that case, the individualized suspicion probable cause system worked. They were able to pick up on what was going on. And even after that point, the Federal Bureau of Prisons allows prisoners to send out sealed outgoing legal mail. So the even despite this happening, the Federal Bureau of Prisons noted, again, categorically lesser magnitude of risk with respect to outgoing legal mail, despite this singular incident. And again, the state of Arizona states that to show a harm, we must show a tangible impact on the attorney-client relationship. Now, Nordstrom said that he self-censored his communication and that he was kept from sharing critically sensitive information. And it's important, Your Honors, that this complaint was dismissed at the screening stage before he had the chance to present evidence of ongoing harm with respect to the chilling, but also with respect to the ethical dilemma in which the threat of reading places upon the attorney representing their client. And again, Mr. Nordstrom is on death row. In this type of case, anything that he might have to say to his attorney on appeal from the death sentence could go to a mitigating factor, could impact his case.
Okay.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thank both sides for their arguments. And before we take a break, I want to say on behalf of the court, thank you to the law students of the University of St. Thomas. Again, as earlier this morning, we're not in any way signaling how we think the case ought to come out, but we would like to thank these law students for a very good job. The case of Nordstrom is now submitted for decision.